What do Ray Kroc, Colonel Sanders, Martha Stewart, Arianna Huffington, and Roger and Donna Beery have in common? They all decided to start businesses in their 50s. And thankfully for us at Cellar Angels, one of them was a wine business. Tonight on SIP episode 122, we sit down with Roger Beery and discuss J. Cage Cellars, a fantastic winery in Windsor, California, in the Sonoma County that happens to produce amazing Pinot Noir-based wines, including what we're tasting this evening, a rosé and a blend cuvée of four different vineyard sites. SIP episode 122, starting a business in your 50s, begins now. It is Friday, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Martin Cody, co-founder of Cellar Angels, your direct-to-consumer wine superstar. I'll go superstar this week. And if it's Friday, SIP happens. That's what we do. Because every single week, we have the opportunity to introduce you to a great, great winery and to do work that we're proud of and to share people with you that you may not know with wines that they're producing. And we do it with the hope that you tell others and bring them into the fold. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the J. Cage Cuvée 42 and the J. Cage 2021 Rosé of Pinot Noir. So tonight's topic is starting a business in your 50s. Our guest is working to log back in. He had, if you remember the blue screen of death, he had the green screen of death. I don't know. It's a newer version of an age-old computer problem. And he's done over 200 Zooms at his winery. So it's interesting. But J. Cage Cellars is tonight's guest. And he and his lovely wife, Donna, started a winery in their 50s. Now, I talk a lot about community because it's very, very important. And I mentioned Sean and Marilyn earlier that they were sitting in the tasting room at Passaggio at Cindy Costco's winery or new tasting room in Glen Ellen. And if you haven't been, I strongly encourage you to go to Glen Ellen because talk about a postcard perfect town that is essentially walkable, a fraction of the size of the downtown Sonoma Square, great restaurants, really solid restaurants. And now three, count them three, Cellar Angels winery partners. You've got Passaggio, you have Laurel Glen, and then you've got that Scottish man who's a little bit off his rocker. He is McLaren, Steve Law, great, great friend who produces just epically good Syrahs, Viogniers, and just a whip of intelligence and comedic value. So I would put Glen Ellen on your tasting map. I've been to Napa Sonoma probably 60 plus times, and I've never had Glen Ellen on my tasting map. Now we detour to go to Glen Ellen. It's less crowded too, by the way, everyone. So you're going to want to go there. All right. So here's what we're going to get into when Roger can join us again. Roger, by the way, had a consulting business on risk management and how to consult businesses on taking on risk. And then he decided to open up a winery, which is arguably one of the riskiest businesses you can open up. So not a very good student of the teacher, so to speak. We're going to talk about J. Cage. We're going to talk about how the J. Cage got their name. We're going to talk about Pinot. And before I do that, I'm actually going to launch a poll question. So I might have just given the hint away, but which variety... And Ivy, is it variety or varietal? MJ, please, we need more definitions. Which variety produces the most expensive wine? I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Mission Control just yelled at me for slurping my wine because I'm on a microphone and I'm not really actually tasting and assessing. So my bad. All right. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. All right. Now this is interesting. We've got every single answer had a selection and was chosen. 7, 2, 2, 5, 6. Okay. The answer is Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir consistently produces the most expensive wine. And in that is Domaine Leroy Musigny Grand Cru in Burgundy. Their wines, I hope you're all sitting down and no one's driving. Doug, I'm looking at you. Their wines on average, are always over $40,000 a bottle. So, and they're all Pinot Noir. And second behind Domaine Leroy is, everyone knows DRC, Domaine Romano Conti, and some of their single vineyard Burgundies. They're all Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir consistently makes the most expensive wines. So you, whoever has Pinot Noir, there are six people that can go into the final round. And no, it's a good question, Michael. Now that, even at auction, Petrus has not been the most expensive bottle sold. So there's a couple different things, because consistently we talk about on average bottles year in and year out, the most expensive, but yes, there are some crazy auction lots. I believe it actually might've been a Romano Conti that went for over $300,000 a bottle. So, but typically the most expensive wines are always Burgundy, always Pinot Noir based. And speaking of Pinot Noir and speaking of community, Sean and Marilyn, as I said, met Roger and Donna at the Passaggio tasting room in Glen Ellen. And Sean just had a comment about that tasting room. It's brand new. It's delightful. It's idyllic. I mean, it's, you're sitting behind me. So I want to introduce Roger, Roger Beery of J. Cage Cellar, tonight's guest. The crowd goes wild.
Better late than never. You know, it's like technology's great when it works great.
It is. It's we covered your infancy. We got through college, and now we're trying to find out. I'm teasing. I want to go, because everyone knows at Cellar Angels we love to promote the small independent producer, mm-hmm. and tell stories worth telling. And you know, you make a small amount of wine. Gallo spills what you make in a week or two, and I'm curious, how did you get into wine from, and I told folks already that you had a consultant business where you helped businesses with risk, but actually you can start at college. Where'd you go to college? And then what did you do after college?
Well, I went to the University of Texas. So I slit my wrist and I bleed Longhorn burn orange. And so I finished my undergraduate, did all my graduate work there. I was actually on faculty teaching risk management for 8 years before, during that time, I was starting my consulting practice. And I had to choose between my mistresses, and the one that made me more money was the consulting practice. But I was kind of tired of the politics of academia anyway. So that all worked out. But yeah, so I grew up in San Antonio, Austin, met my wife when we were in middle school. And started dating at the end of high school. And so the real way I got into wine was, you may remember the Galloping Gourmet, Graham Kerr.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I loved watching his show. You know, he was the only guy chef, and he was pretty bawdy back then. And he always would invite the pretty girl from the audience to come sit on the bistro table and have the dish he cooked and make these very off-color, sexy things and introduce her to wine to go with it. So I don't know why my computer's doing that again. So can you hear me okay?
Yeah, your audio's fine, and you're right.
There we go.
Graham would have, in today's day and age, he would have had a lot of visits to HR.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, I was this, 18-year-old kid trying to figure out a shtick with girls. And I was overweight and I stuttered in high school. So I wasn't the biggest prize. Right. And so I thought, wow, this wine thing. And it turns out I loved it. And then when Donna and I started dating, she loved wine. And so that's so Graham Kerr is the one that pointed me in that direction so I could pick up girls at 1974. But that wasn't what made my wine world work, but we'll get to that later. But so we started coming out here in the early 80s and fell in love with California wines, and we had wine country, and we just became very passionate about.
What brought you out there in the 80s? From Texas. I mean, you know, why go there?
There was a restaurant in Austin called Mezzaluna that was sort of the epicenter of the Austin wine scene. If anybody here is familiar with Austin, it was owned by a guy named Reed Clement, who now owns the Grove Wine Bars in Austin. But no, I just, like I said, I fell in love with wine. I was kind of doing the wine scene when I got out of graduate school, a little bit in downtown Austin, and met some wine people. Was really getting into it. And then the miracle that was Mezzaluna opened, which is an amazing Italian restaurant, but it was the first really wine-focused wine bar. And my office was, two blocks away in downtown Austin. And, I know the manager. And so, we spent a lot of time at Mezzaluna.
Super cool. I mean, that's amazing. And you were how old? Fake ID or past 21?
I was in my mid-late 20s at this time. It was before the kids were born. I was 32 when our son was born. So, and so I just really got into it. And then we had this couple that was a client. He was a client, and they were a bit older, probably 10 years older than us, maybe a little more. And John and Jennifer Bird, and they were really into wine. So we made our first trips in 83 and 84 out here with John and Jennifer Bird. And, it was just amazing. Amazing. And, back then you just drove around. Oh, hell, there's a winery. Let's go check it out.
Right. Unfortunately, there's less of that now, still a little bit, but we've had some of our best experiences just rambling up and down roads and Dry Creek and stuff like that and knocking on doors. Sure. And so you started going out to wine country in the 80s. You still had this consulting business in Austin. How long did you?
The next 30 years.
Okay. So in the next 30 years, and what were you consulting on? What was the consulting business?
Risk management consulting for the automobile dealership industry.
Wow.
Yeah. And I sold the company to in 2015 to focus on this. And as I like to tell my friends out here in California, you sell a successful consulting firm that is based in Denver and Austin, and it does not get the multiples of a broke tech firm that will never see profitability. People get excited, stock goes up because they didn't lose as much. I wish my banker felt the same way.
Yeah, the bankers seldom have a very good sense of humor about those things.
Yeah.
So you decide in 2015, you sell the business. You're already very, very passionate about wine.
We started the winery in 2014.
Okay.
So and basically,
I want to go back a little bit before then. And I mean, historically, people get into wine kind of the same innocence that you had. You get exposed to someone that knows a little bit more about it than you do. And then pretty soon a seed takes hold, and then you start doing the exploration. Then you go to your first visit, and you go up and down 29, you go up and down 101, and then pretty soon you're like, well, hang on, we've been out there four or five times. This is a lot of fun. But you're a Pinot Noir savant. Where did the love for Pinot come?
So before we started the winery, as you know, Don and I wrote Bacchus and Berry Wine Blog for many years. That was a very popular wine blog when people used to read long form blogs. And so I started interviewing. Well, part of it is I started gravitating towards Sonoma. I got tired of the big rich guy, vanity label thing. And, in Napa, although there's, plenty of others, that are not that, but, right. It seems to be the dominant force now. And I started gravitating, Don and I both, more and more to Sonoma. We found it was just more real. The people were more real. The wineries were smaller. There was more passion. But the two guys that, really, really turned me on to Pinot Noir and made me understand it was Adam Lee from Siduri, who is our consulting winemaker and an Austin expat. And we used to drink together at Mezzaluna before he moved out here.
No way.
Yeah, absolutely. I was talking to his kids the other day. We stopped by the tasting room to help us with some photography. And they said, Dad says he's known you a long time. How long? I said, well, before he moved out here. Oh, no, didn't realize that. But then the other guy was James McPhail. James had a huge impact on me really understanding Pinot and the intricacies and the delicacies. And And I don't really make a delicate Pinot. You know, look, I'm a 6'3", 260 pound Texan. I don't make wimpy wines. And so, but you can still make, you know, fairly large Pinots, but still be very nuanced. And so that was when, you know, and there were other Pinot producers too, but Adam and James were the ones that really sort of turned my head on Pinot Noir and made me really passionate about wanting to do Pinot Noir.
And James has had quite a successful run with Pinot Noir. And we've had, that's the understatement of the decade. Yeah. James was on the program. We featured McPhail quite a few years ago, I think just shortly before he sold. And you guys have to be friends because I think you're both, like you said, 6'3". He's got to be 6'3" or 4".
And he's in much better shape than me, though.
Fun fact.
And James, little known fact, James plays the bagpipes.
I can believe that. James can play anything he wants with that frame. But fun fact, if you go and onto the Cellar Angels website and search for McPhail, when I interviewed James, it looks like we're neck and neck. I'm standing on a milk crate off camera. That's how tall this gentleman is.
Yeah.
He's a big, wonderful man making unbelievable Pinot.
So his current brand is Tongue Dancer.
Okay.
And
so I can go with that I won't.
Well, you and everybody else. So he predominantly is a consulting winemaker now and consults on some pretty big brands like The Calling and, you know, some of those others. So, yeah.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Had a blast filming with him. That was awesome. All right. So now you start the winery. You have a love of Pinot.
But I want to back up for a minute, if I might.
Yes.
Because when we were talking earlier, you said, what was that moment?
Yeah, the wine epiphany.
The epiphany moment. So the epiphany moment was on one of those trips in 83 and 84, or 84 and 85. And I sent Denise the picture. In a minute, she can put it up. And so we're driving around, the birds and Don and me, and we're in the mid-80s Lincoln land yacht. You remember you used to rent those big Lincoln Continentals?
Yep.
And we were driving around, and there we are. And we ran into, we saw Camus. And look at me there. See, I had hair and everything back then. and you notice the Texas Longhorn belt buckle, please. I told you, I bleed Longhorn burnt orange. So we come up on, and it's a rainy November day. It's after harvest. And we pull up in this big Lincoln and there's no one there. We get out and Charlie Wagner, you know, walks out and what do you want? Well, he was not known for Mr. Hospitality. It's like, well, you know, we want to taste your wines. And we really like Camus. And he goes, well, you can't taste my wines unless you understand, you know, my vineyards, how I make the wines. And so basically he was looking at these guys from Texas in this big fancy car that are dressed nice. Of course, I had loafers on, and it's muddy and it's raining. And it's a challenge. Are you going to walk in the vineyard or not? You know, well, 4.5 hours later when we left, it was this meeting with Charlie that really made me understand this thing about wine, not a consumer product. It is agriculture, it's science, it's art, and a little bit of alchemy. And it was my time, it was that afternoon with Charlie that really changed my understanding of wine and you know, the whole thing versus a consumer product. It's like, I drink bourbon, but you know, it's distilled and you know, it's a consumer product.
Yeah. Right. No, it's a great point. And the Angels have heard me talk about it a lot. And I mentioned it in the intro about how the wine community and wine in itself brings people together.
Absolutely.
And it's, I mean, as I mentioned during the prep, Robert Keenan said it best or said it really well when he said, you put a bottle of wine on a table in front of a group of people, it immediately changes the alchemy of the group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, as we were talking, I was in the tasting room right before I came here. And there was a family there, and the dad who was, you know, was the dad, his son, a dad, his wife, his 30-something son, wife, and grandchild. And the guy that was my age started bringing that up. And it's like, you know, nothing brings people together like wine.
Right. Yeah. And it's a magical beverage. One, someone I've heard it described as living art. And I have.
Oh, yeah, believe absolutely.
Because it definitely changes. It evolves. I love the musical analogies where, and we'll talk about this in kind of your portfolio, where when you get a wine that has the nuance and all the pieces are hitting it, I mean, it is a little bit like a symphony. Everyone, all of it comes together to produce something magical. Mm-hmm. However, there are times when a solo is required and the flutist will stand up or the celloist will stand up and will not stand up with the cello. Those are big instruments.
Yeah, it's kind of hard for the cellos to stand up.
Yeah. And so, but I like that aspect of wine. You don't get that with any other beverage. I mean, it changes every year when you're in limited production, not when you're in mass produced wines. They're the same.
No, because you're trying to make the same wine every year. You're blending, so you make the same wine every year. Kendall Jackson and Chardonnay taste the same every year.
Right. It's very formulaic. It's a lot of it's in the lab. A lot of it is, there's a formula. And mm-hmm. So that's what you need to do when you're making 5 to 10 million cases. You can't have vintage variation.
Not when you're making 2,200 cases. It's all about the vintage variation. You know, do you want poster art in your house or do you want original art in your house? Kendall Jackson, Gallo, Prairie Wines, that's poster art.
Yep.
Small producers are actual art.
So we're gonna talk a little bit about the wines. But I'm going to, before I get to the rosé, we're going to launch the second poll question. So this is for the audience, and then Roger, you will answer the correct answers. What are the typical aromas and flavors one can expect to find in a rosé of Pinot Noir? And speaking of that, I'll pour myself some more. Oh, thank you, MJ. I happen to agree with Mr. Stevenson. Ten, nine, eight, seven, six, five, four and a half, three, two, one. All right, now this is interesting. Because according to the audience and 4 out of 5 dentists that were surveyed, if anybody was going to tell you that their liquor or their Pinot Noir or their rosé tastes like licorice or grass, they, to our fans, would be wrong. The predominant answers are watermelon and blueberry. And so since we have one of the experts on, Roger, give us an example of what typical aromas of a rosé of Pinot Noir one would expect to see.
Well, I don't, I love blueberry in my Pinots, my red Pinots, but in my rosé, now I like watermelon's okay, but I like more things like ripe strawberry, red cherry, those kind of, you know, bright red kind of, you know, both aromas and flavors. And I think in the rosé we're having now, you get a lot of that sort of bright cherry, you get that. Yeah, maybe a little cranberry, somebody said. Yeah, absolutely. A touch of watermelon, but I get more, you know, sort of cherry, ripe strawberry kind of notes.
Very good. I'm sorry. There's that Mission Control, again, just condemned me for slurping. I don't know if you do this, Roger, since you're in the business. I slurp my wines all the time, can't help it. Sometimes I slurp milk. I've slurped root beer. I just slurp beverages.
Yeah, it's life.
Thank you. So Mission Control, stop yelling at me in my ear. All right, so where did the name Jay Cage come from?
So our last name is Beery, beer with a Y. So that's a horrible winery name, Beery Family Wines, confusing at best, if not illegal. So Jay Cage was my great-grandfather and a patriarch in my Austin, Texas upbringing and family. And so
Jay Cage, so this is on the picture on the left, who's that?
So that is Jay Cage and my father. So
wow.
So yeah, so that's on Lake Austin, and You can see the cute little outfit my father was dressed in. And my grandmother, who was Jay Cage's daughter, dressed up our son in those same little outfits. And we kind of had to let her do it when she did it, you know, because she was the matriarch. So someone asked about the Bat Bridge. So we need to come back to this for the Cuvée 42. This is not the Bat Bridge. This is the Lamar Boulevard Bridge, which is about six blocks west of the Congress Street Bridge, which is the Bat Bridge.
Awesome. And so tell me about the Lamar Boulevard Bridge.
Well, can we wait till we get to the Cuvée 42? Because the whole name has to do with that.
Oh, okay. I think we should, Mission Control. Take that down, please. Thank you. All right, good. So we now know that the family name is not necessarily Beery, the winery name. So that's good.
Right.
I'm still interested in that transition to selling the consulting business that you've spent a lifetime on risk.
Yeah, on risk. Yeah, exactly.
Go into wine, which apparently has zero risk.
Obviously so. As I tell people, I learned nothing from my years of academia and consulting other people, because the only thing riskier would have been a small family restaurant. But so Don and I, what we didn't realize over all these years was our passion for wine was rubbing off on our kids as they were growing up. And so our son Conk, like a conch shell, he's our winemaker, but I'm usually the boots on the ground, because in real life, he runs a custom crush and has 25 clients. He makes wine for some pretty famous ones. Wow. And that's his day job that actually puts a roof over his head. But he was at Texas Tech and sort of floundering between his sophomore and junior year. And they announced the first viticulture enology program in the state of Texas. And he jumped on it. He enrolled immediately over the summer. We were not real happy about it, because we didn't think he really understood what winemaking was about. And right. He really didn't drink a lot of wine. He grew up around great wine, but he was like one of those, you know, Dad, this wine's awesome. Can I have a beer? You know, frat kids. And right. So, sort of the funny story, if he was here, is I said, well, you know, son, being winemaker is really hard work. It's not all winemaker tours or vineyard tours and winemaker dinners. And you've never worked a hard day in your life. And so he said, Dad, so he played high school and college golf. He says, Dad, I know what hard work is. I work at Golfsmith for those of you that used to be a golf superstore. Sometimes I'm on my feet 6 hours a day selling golf clubs. I know what hard work is. I said, that's my point, son. You don't. But anyway, he took to it like a duck to water, and has made wine all over the world. Made wine for Kim Crawford, Costa Brown, made a lot of wine in Texas with Chris Bruntred, who's probably the most famous winemaker in Texas, William Chris Winery. And that was what he did in college, and then did all the internship things. And then his last internship was at Costa Brown, which is where he learned to make Pinot. Then he was 3 years in the cellar at Gunlock Bunshu. Then he was cellar master and assistant winemaker at Long Meadow Ranch and Farmstead on the dark side in Napa. And now he is the production winemaker and general manager at Opal Moon. The other thing that happened is our passion rubbed off on our daughter, Whitney. And so I got that call about 3 months before graduation that all of us with college age or have had college age kids dread. Dad, I've had a change of heart with my major. And so the good news was the change of heart was that she, instead of going into resort management, with at that time, Don and I kind of viewed our future as, you know, traveling the world, staying at great resorts on Whitney's discount. But no, she said, I want to go into wine country hospitality, and I want to work for Jordan Winery based on a father-daughter trip that we made for her 21st birthday. And Whitney's just about to celebrate her 10th anniversary and now runs all hospitality and VIP at Jordan. I'm very fortunate to have both of the kids here. But in 2014, to your point, We've been writing the wine blog. I became increasingly envious of these people that walked away from, you know, like solid middle-class lives. I mean, not, you know, not people with a lot of capital. And, you know, a friend of mine, you know, from Minneapolis, basically divorced, packed up his Volvo, came out, took a $16 an hour intern job, and now he's a very successful winemaker. But Cindy Costco is a great story. You know, your friend Cindy, you know, she walked away from retirement as a police officer like 3 years before retirement.
I've got a couple questions to ask you on the story. What was more disappointing to you as a parent, that Conk went to tech or wanted to get into wine?
Well, so the way I soothed my soul on that, Martin, that's a great question. I have no idea why my thing's doing this, but I'm glad you can hear me. That's a great question. And the way we soothe our souls is both of their majors were not offered at the University of Texas.
Oh, there you go. There you go. So how many letters have you written to UT Austin to say, hey, guys, get with the times. We need these majors.
Yeah, no, winemaking is not a thing for the University of Texas. And, you know, hospitality is Texas Tech and University of Houston. They sort of have the, you know, have the thing on that. So, so that all worked out fine.
All right, let me do this. I want to talk about the rosé. So
I'm going to stop my camera here for a second and restart it and see if that helps.
That's fine. I mean, your audio is great, by the way, so it's booming. Oh. And I'm curious, was there a rosé that mesmerized you, or is it just, hey, I can make Pinot of rosé and what's
No, Don and I have always loved Pinot Noir rosé. And I'm not really wild about any other rosés. I'll drink them occasionally, you know. French rosés to me, they don't linger on the palate. You know, it's kind of great if it's hot and you want some, teases the tip of your tongue and then it sort of, you know, disappears. So you're tasting this is a really nice, robust rosé. It stays on your palate a long time. And so we lovingly call it a brosé. It's a manly rosé.
Interesting.
There was when we had a distributor in Denver, there was a French restaurant in Cherry Creek that carried the rosé. And so we go in there and she goes, Roger, I have the perfect pairing for your rosé. So I'm figuring it's going to be a salmon. It's going to, you know, all the stuff, you know, you're used to.
Usual suspects.
And so it's a French restaurant, and I had never had French style steak tartare before. And I generally not a steak tartare fan because I don't like heat that goes through my nose. So no horseradish, no wasabi, all that sort of stuff. Married to a woman that's half Chinese, that was a conflict. But that being said, so French style steak tartare is citrus and capers. And it was an amazing pairing with this rosé. And I'm proud to say my rosé stands up to raw beef.
You don't hear that often enough. You don't hear that often enough.
So, but what I really love it with too is a tuna steak. Oh, yeah. Seared ahi.
Yeah, I can totally see that. And there's a couple gourmands on tonight. And Nick is one of them. Jeff and Jane are one of them. Sean is one of them. These folks know their way around a grill and know their way around fish. So that sounds heavenly. Alyssa, I love the bowl glass you're drinking out of. That is awesome. That holds some Pinot. There you go. I like that, mommy. That's a good sippy cup right there. All right. So the Pinot Noir was McPhail and Siduri influenced. I mean,
and Russian Adam Lee, yes.
And Adam Lee, got it. All right. I'm going to show some folks where you're located as we talk about it, because this is, make no mistake, this is Jeff's favorite part of the show and when I stop talking. So let's get, hey, don't agree with me on that. All right. So Roger and the new folks, as I mentioned at the beginning, we live, die, eat, breathe limited production wineries from Napa and Sonoma. I mean, it is our mission. We've been doing this for 13 years to help elevate this portion of the wine industry, because For us, the romantics of the world, it is the fabric of the wine industry. Yeah. And so when we talk about where does Cellar Angels focus, it is indeed Napa and Sonoma County. So as we zoom in on these two wonderful counties, and I will pull back a second so you can actually see what's happening here. Roger is in the Sonoma side in Windsor, but also where we get the rosé, you source wines and fruit from outside of the county. And I'm
curious. This is the only time we have. So 60% of this is Sonoma County.
Right. Well, and it's interesting because last week when we were talking about with Tambor Bay and Barry Waite, the proprietor there, he made the same comment that they're elevating their Pinot Noir program. And he said, and we actually decided we had to go outside of Sonoma County to get the fruit that we wanted. And
well, that's not what happened here.
Okay. Tell me about your decision to go outside.
So what happened was, we love this vineyard that in Sonoma County that we picked specifically for rosé. It is, all clone 115, which I think is a great blending clone normally, but I think it's perfect for Pinot Rosé. In the past, we've pressed it and we did this one. And then we might add a little bit of our own Sonier to give it a little more backbone. But this year, or that in 2021, Adam Lee, who with his project now, Floris Wines, we both make our wines at the same winery. He calls me up and he goes, I've got some Sonier from Gary Pisoni's vineyard. I think if we blended that with your press rosé, it would be effing awesome.
Now, time out. Well, when you say I've got some Sonier, what does that mean?
Okay, so Sonier is a French term. And so basically you're bleeding the juice off before fermentation. And there's a couple reasons why you may do that. So it has a couple of days of skin contact as opposed to our press rosé, which goes in is treated like a white wine and pressed right away. And so you do that for a couple of reasons. One is you may want to make a richer wine than you think you're going to get. So you bleed off some of that juice before fermentation. You're increasing your skin to juice ratio. You're going to make a richer wine. Another reason, yes, Pisoni is down in Monterey. You are correct. Another reason people do it is to lower the alcohol. So if you pick the fruit a little too ripe and you don't want it to, you don't want to make a 16% alcohol Pinot. And, sometimes we get to pick our dates, but sometimes Mother Nature is a fickle business partner. You can basically bleed some off and you replace that with water. And so you're keeping the same skin to juice ratio, but you're basically bringing out some of the sugar. So less sugar to ferment, it's going to be lower alcohol. So anyway, Adam Collins says, I've got this great juice from Gary Pisoni's vineyard. I think if we blend it with your press rosé, it'll knock it out of the park. And I'm like, this wine has rosé in it. This rosé has Pinot in it that should never be in a rosé. Of course I'll take it.
Exactly.
So, yep. Yeah, it has made this amazing wine.
And it's funny because we talk often about how every great wine region, specifically Napa and Sonoma County, has the proximity of water. And here, even Jeff, this is Salinas, and we're just on the northern edge of America's salad bowl, where you start getting into the Central Coast and the valley, which is where all of the great produce is grown. But perfect example, you're looking at this is what? I mean, it's not far away. It's 24 miles from the ocean. And it is right between two valley or two mountain ranges, if you will. And it is pretty special. I mean, here's a river right here. If I were to focus on this, this is the Salinas River that has basically over the million of years carved this valley. And so now when you imagine very similar to the Russian River, which we've showed quite a few times, as this thing floods and breaches its banks and then recedes, breaches its banks and recedes millions of years, the amount of material in this soil that can contribute to what Roger was talking about earlier with regards to some of the, not only watermelon, but strawberry, cranberry, some of those types of elements, all from the soil, is what makes this whole area so special, because this is just a basin of erosion. So now I want to move on to Cuvée 42.
Okay.
So talk to me about the name.
So Cuvée 42 is our first multi-vineyard blended multi-vineyard Sonoma County Pinot. So we don't want to use the word blend. We also have the Craftsman's Blend, which is a killer barbecue wine. I call it my ultimate Texas barbecue wine. That one's Sangiovese, Zinfandel, and Petit Sirah. So with this one, the cuvée means a blend, so a blend of vineyards. And the 42, if you want to bring the bridge back up, we wanted to have a family reference. We wanted to keep something in the family. And Jay Cage, his lasting legacy was he designed and his road company built the Lamar Boulevard Bridge. Now, this bridge here that you see is not very popular in Austin. It is it's a four-lane bridge, but very narrow for four lanes. But it's a registered historic landmark, an architectural landmark. I learned on a virtual tasting from a professor at Florida State, it is a small bridge architectural landmark. So the bottom line is, it can't touch it. And so there's a couple reasons why it's so famous, and we can see them both here. One is how it reflects in these perfect ovals in Town Lake, now known as Lady Bird Johnson Lake, but reflects in these perfect ovals, which is just beautiful when everything's right. But the other thing that was sort of an engineering feat for Jay Cage, he went by Frank. It was Joseph Frank Cage. His road building company, Cage Brothers, they were able to do these what are called Art Deco spandrels in single pour concrete. And so there was not a lot of steel in 1942, the year the bridge opened, hence the name, because of the wars. But he was able to design it so it'd be single pour. So generally, I'm using my cursor here because I'm used to being in control of the Zoom. But if you look sort of in the middle of each of those spandrels, if you saw other bridges of similar design in that era, there would be a buttress there. So you would just have, quarter circles or ovals. Yep. But he was able to design it that way.
Impressive.
That's it. And it's kind of fun because you're looking south to north. If you get off the north end of the bridge in downtown, the first thing you see is the world headquarters of a little Austin startup you might have heard of, Whole Foods Market. Which, by the way, if you're ever in Austin and you get a chance to go at Lamar and Sixth to the world headquarters of Whole Foods Market, go there. But plan to spend 3 or 4 hours. It is not a grocery store like you've ever seen. They do have a wine bar there. You can drink wine there. You can take wine while you go shopping. It's great. It's Texas.
So you're sourcing for the cuvée from four different vineyards. The first one we're showing here, and I'm detecting, off up here in the distance, you can see Santa Rosa, a little bit of mountain fruit here. I mean, this looks like some pretty interesting topography.
Yeah. So I don't normally tell this story, but you, I think, Martin, have a pretty savvy group here. So let's talk about how this wine came to be. So normally we make single vineyard wine. Single vineyard Pinots are Sauvignon Blanc, which is a big workhorse for us. People love it. It's very Sancerre style, single vineyard, or Chardonnay single vineyard. And for me, these vineyards, I think vineyards are like voices. There's some that deserve to be the lead singer, the solo artist. There's a lot that sing great in the chorus, and even more that should never sing outside the shower. But the more I drink, the better I sing, or at least I think. But what ended up happening that year was we had lost our Hallberg vineyard, and we wanted another single vineyard. So There was a vineyard that some of my friends had made great wines from called Starscape. And so that's in the Russian River. So you're focusing, it looks like, on Vanderkamp on top of Sonoma Mountain there. Yep. Go to Trenton Healdsburg, number four. Okay. So this used to be called Floodgate. And a Chinese industrialist bought the property. He's the world's second largest producer of polyester. And so somewhere in your stretchy clothes or underwear band, you probably have some of his polyester. But so we thought, so we thought this would be great. We got an opportunity to make a single vineyard wine there. And our wines were, if you take that block right above where it says Cuvée 42 Trenton, so put your cursor, yeah, right there on that block. So we sort of were on the, if you go to a little above center of that block and then you go down, that was our fruit.
Okay.
We had challenges with the growing. We had challenges with the vineyard manager. We had challenges trying to figure out exactly what our rows were, which is very strange. Other people were too. And apparently when the Chinese guy, he kept the same vineyard manager, but cut the budget. But anyway, so we made the wine, the fruit came in. It was kind of like, you know, I don't think this is the stuff we were sampling, but okay. But we made the wine and the intent was to make it a single vineyard. And so what happened was that we got to about this time of year and Conk goes to the winery and he's tasting through all the barrels and he tastes the Starscape. Polyester was a great dance club in Austin. Yes, I'm showing my age now. But in any case, Conk calls me and goes, yeah, I want you and Adam to go taste this wine. Said, it's good. It's good. There's nothing wrong, but I want you guys to go taste it and then let's talk. So Adam and I both go taste it and go, yeah, it's fine, but it's not special. It's not that solo artist. And so we call Conk, he goes, yeah, that's exactly it. It's not the solo artist. So we said, let's take some of our single vineyard, blend it in, and make a really great entry-level Pinot Noir. So we added a bit of our Vanderkamp, which is on top of Sonoma Mountain. That's a very highly rated single vineyard. It's very Burgundian. It's about 25% Latoche clone. You're talking about expensive Burgundies when I came on. And so they have one of the rare ones that have Latoche. And so so the Vanderkamp is somewhat more Burgundian. If you tasted all my Pinots, that would be the one that you go, you know, this is different than the others, but it gives nice backbone to this. And then we added some of our Wedding Block Pinot Noir, which is off the Martinelli estate in Russian River. And that gives it a little bit more of that Russian River dark cherry, dark chocolate. And then sort of the piece de resistance on this is we added a bit of our El Coro vineyard from the Petaluma Gap. And that's our highest rated Pinot every year. You know, it gets, you know, between 94 and 96 every year. And that one, the real calling card on it, if you buy it, if you drink it as a single vineyard, is it really has this really nice cinnamon and baking spice on the finish. Vineyard gives. So I love it with things like lamb and duck, sort of gamier meats. It's perfect with that. But so what happens now is we've got these two vineyards, Starscape and Wedding Block, which we do the single vineyard Wedding Block, Russian River Valley. And so that's giving us that nice dark cherry, blueberry, and chocolate on the finish. The Vanderkamp gives it some beautiful structure. And then the El Coro is just enough so that that you get a little bit of that spice mixed in with that dark chocolate. And they just dance together beautifully, I think.
No, that's interesting. And it's funny that you mentioned the Martinelli Vineyard, and Sipsters remember Lise Asamont from Dot Wines, who has a Pinot Noir clone tattoo and has spoken fondly, quite fondly, of the Martinelli Vineyards, where her first Pinot Noir was sourced from. So
different Martinelli Vineyards, same Martinelli family, but different vineyards. Yeah.
Ah, okay. Amazing wine growers. So
yes, they are. And great to work with. Lee Martinelli, just awesome to work with.
So what are we looking at from here on a aroma standpoint, flavors and pairings?
Unfortunately, I don't have a bottle open, but I'm still on the rosé. But no, I get this nice, aromas of red cherry, dark cherry, a little blueberry. Oh, by the way, on the label, front label, that's a sketch of one of those Art Deco spandrels that you saw there. Yeah, so that's a sketch of one of those spandrels. But so those really nice Pinot flavors. I think, it's very robust in its aromas. But then you get to this sort of nuanced Pinot. But really what I like about this Pinot is that I think it's a great Pinot to serve when you want to serve a really good wine at home, but the wine's not the thing. The football game's the thing. The dinner's the thing. The friends getting together that haven't seen each other are the thing. And you want one of those wines where people taste and go, wow, this is really good, but what about the reason we're here? And that's it. Yeah, that's it. So that's our goal in making this, is it's a really nice, easy drinking, beautiful Pinot. It's, it's pretty nuanced, but it doesn't have to be.
Well, I think Karen hit the cheeses out of the park. Fantastic. Brie and Gorgonzola. Is there a dish, Roger, that you know is can't miss with this?
Well, it's like all Pinots, man. Pigs and Pinot. Anything pork. Ribs are great. Now, you got to understand, being from Texas, we don't do sauce. We're all about spice world. So as my father used to say growing up, sauce insults the chef. So you wouldn't want this with ribs with a sweet sauce. But if you do some nice smoked ribs with a good rub on them, boy, it'd be great with that. I really like this also, and I'm actually going to have this tonight with some lamb pops.
Oh, that actually would kill.
Yeah.
I agree. Three or four of those dishes. And yes, folks, I want to see some pictures of your dishes on Instagram. Tag Jay Cage, tag Cellar Angels, and let's see what you've got from a call.
Yeah, so it's at Jay Cage Cellars. You can find us on there, Facebook as well. And we have a private, our wine club is called the Weinstein Dreamers. We do have a private page. If you find that, click on it and I'll let you in, of course.
And then, Roger, how do folks come taste with you?
Well, so we do have a tasting room in downtown Windsor. For those of you that maybe aren't familiar with Windsor, it's sort of been thought of as a drive-by town, but we are halfway between Santa Rosa and Healdsburg. And we've got a beautiful town green. The problem is the 101 goes through and there's big trees and you don't really see Windsor. But there's six tasting rooms or six wineries. We actually share our tasting room with Mingler Family Wines. You can go and taste all, both, whatever. It's not separated by one or the other. The best thing to do though is to make an appointment, because I'm not always there, but I do my best to do the personal tastings for the people that make appointments. And I really like doing that. The guys in the tasting room are okay, but they're tasting room guys, that's not what for a lot of people, that's great. They want to belly up to the bar, have five wines and buy two bottles and life's good for them. But that's not what you're about. I can tell that just looking at your face. It's, you guys aren't about that. So make an appointment, online, and you can make a note, say, hey, I was on Cellar Angels, let's do, this VIP tasting. And, we have scripted tastings, but of course, you know, especially if you guys, we will definitely off-road, as you say.
It's, and by the way, Windsor, Roger's 100% correct as usual. It doesn't get the recognition it deserves, quite honestly. And my guess is the locals probably like that because they're fearful that we don't want to be the next Healdsburg, which was a sleepy little town 15, 18 years ago, and now it's exploded. There's good and bad with that. But as you can see, you know, you've got Santa Rosa down here, you've got Healdsburg up here, and Windsor 101 does in fact go right through it almost. But when you get off of 101 and come into downtown Windsor, Mission Control and I have had several meetings with wineries and stuff in here, and there's a bunch of great little coffee shops, great tasting rooms, cute little restaurants. I mean, it is a nice, nice place. And it's not as crowded as Healdsburg. I mean,
oh God, no. I wish it was more crowded. People ask me all the time locally, say, well, how's the tasting room doing? I say, well, it's Windsor.
Yeah, exactly. So it is a beautiful town. So there's two towns you need to add to your itineraries, Glen Ellyn and Windsor, because both of them are a little bit off the beaten path, but boy, there are some undiscovered gems within those towns.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it, I like the Angel bonus offer. There is a VIP tasting. It is, wait, what did Karen say? We want the soil to barrel story. I don't know if
there's a story.
Okay.
So, Karen, would you expand on that a little bit in the chat?
We're going now to our live audience for some feedback.
So one thing I will say while she's typing. So when we make our single vineyard wines, we pick the same ripeness. The winemaking is exactly the same. The barrel program's the same. And the thing is, I want you to hear these voices. And if we're too heavy in our winemaking, then you taste winemaker. You may love the wines, but they're not going to taste different enough. And I want you and whoever you're tasting with to have a spirited discussion on which one is best, which of course the one that's best is the one that tastes best to you. But, you know, as someone said a long time ago, wine's a weird thing. And that if I was staying at your house and we get up for breakfast and they say, do you want some orange juice? They go, no, I'm not really wild about orange juice. How about some apple? Okay, apple's great. You know, there's no question. But then it's like, you serve me this wine and go, what do you think? I go, hey, I'm not that wild, but what do you mean? This is a great wine. And now you're trying to convince me, or I'm trying to convince you. And that's sort of a funny thing about wine. We get very attached to the things we like and, you know, recognize that if we all tasted the world the same way, Gallo would make it and come in a bag in a box.
Exactly. And Karen, by the way, if you want to turn on your mic, feel free. We trust you.
Okay. So the soil contributes to the vine. Absolutely. Age of the vine, depth of vines. Let me pull that up so I see the whole thing. Fermentation process to use, barrel length of time, all that. Okay. So yes. Yeah. The soils.
Roger, I think the important point is most people want the basics. The sipsters want the deets. They want the detail.
Got it. So all of our vineyards have very different soils. All the Pinot vineyards are very different. Jeff and Jane, yes. My wife used to get on me with when we were writing the blog. It's like, you're getting too geeky. But yeah, exactly. So, you know, all the soils are different, but they all work great for Pinot. So as I said, we pick it about the same ripeness, about 24 bricks. Our barrel program, we use about 20% new French oak. We predominantly use Gamba and a couple other barrels. Basically, it's what Conk picked up from his time at Kosta Browne, Gamba and Boots. We've got others too. So, you know, we're picking in September, you know, generally. We're done by the end of September. Fermentation takes, you know, 2 weeks. Maybe a little bit longer. And then it gets pressed and it goes into barrel. Now, we sort of take a different approach to our blending. I call it the chili approach. So mid to late month, next month, Adam and Conk and I will get together And so we'll do barrel tastings. And so we'll look at, we'll taste through the barrels. We'll decide which ones we want to put together for the single vineyards. And then we may have a couple left over. They're not bad. They just don't make the best single vineyard. And then, you know, we'll use those in another blend or something, another blended Pinot. We did a Russian River in 21 that we're just about to release now. We do that. Once we decide what that blend is, then we take the wine out of the barrel, we put it in a chilled tank, we let it sit for a day, then we put it back in barrel. So the wines from the barrels for the first, you know, 6 months, if you will, 5 months, now are blended. So we're getting those flavors blended together. Now they're going to taste different once again when we go to bottling, because the barrels will have impact. But then other winemakers will blend right at bottling. But for us, we feel like the longer the wines can homogenize together, the sooner it's going to, be a really nice drinkable wine. So right. I call it the chili approach, because we all know that chili is better the second day.
And it's also never the same recipe twice.
No. It's all our own taste. So basically when we do blending, the way we do it, we sit around this big table, we taste through all the wines. Comp makes his own blend of the various barrels. I make mine, Adams makes his, then we blind taste them. And then we pick one. And we go, okay, how can we make this better? And so that's about six. I'm sorry.
Jeff asked a little bit about that early on. How do you take four blends from four different vineyards, very different vineyards, and then you sit around the table and how do you decide this little, a dash of that, a sprinkle of this, a smidge of that, and how do we?
Yeah, so what I'm talking about right now is how we do our single vineyards.
Yeah.
So that's how we do our single vineyards. Then we've got these other barrels. And it's just a matter of, you know, it's alchemy at that point. I wish I could tell you that, you know, if this was a big winery, they have very different ways, but we very much bootstrap it. But I'll tell you, Adam Lee's palate is just unfreaking believable. I mean, he's the one that'll go, you know, I think we need half a barrel of that one. And he's always right. I mean, his palate is, with barrel tasting, is just unbelievable. All right, now you got my hands up there till it's up here. Yeah.
I like it.
But it's definitely a team effort, and Adam's a big part of that team, for sure. First year we made wines without him and they were good in spite of ourselves. And now I think they're good because of our team.
Kill your camera for a second, because I'm laughing. I love that.
I know. Let's see what happens.
The most animated charades game ever. All right, there we go. I don't know.
Yeah. Never happened before.
Roger, you have been amazing to be this patient and to stay with us for this long and this person.
No, this is, I was you guys when I was writing the blog. I was the geeky blogger. We go interview and Donna was like, I'm getting bored. Quit asking about the barrel program. Nobody cares.
She might have had a hint of accuracy there, but a lot of times people do care. And by the way, you guys can still check out the Beery and Bacchus blog, or the Bacchus and Beery blog. And because I used to read late editions of that, and it was long form. And that's how I learned. I mean, it was just, I like reading long form. We're in an instant gratification, instant world. And
Instagram and Facebook made us all attention deficit.
Yeah, exactly. Next week, Sipsters, I want to let you know, I will let them know, Mission Control admonishing me for like the ninth time during one episode. You can always find episodes on our YouTube channel. If you haven't subscribed, please do so. If you miss something because you're going to a Minnesota sporting event or symphony or an amateur volleyball tournament or another Minnesota amateur basketball tournament, yes, I'm looking at you, Doug. Okay. You can always catch up to that. But I do want to let you know that next week we are going to be introducing Elaine Wines. And I don't mean introducing like it's the first time Elaine has ever produced a Pinot Noir, but Sipsters, if you are here next week, you are going to participate and help her select her clonal selection for the next. So you want to talk about virtual audience participation? I don't think it gets much better than that. And we're clonal geeks, as Roger has already attested. The clone makes the difference, especially when it's matched with the right soils. So we are indebted, sir, for your time with us this evening.
It's been great. I mean, this is, you know, this is why I do what I do. I love to share the art with people that get it. And, you know, I hope I get to meet you guys in, you know, IRL, as they say, and, you know, in real life. And next time you want to have a thing about you know, clonal blending, that's all another thing. Yeah. So I will tell you that basically all our single vineyard Pinots are different combinations of different clones. Some play well with each other, some don't. That's part of the learning.
Mission Control is going to put a YouTube video link in from Roger, and it's the Weinstein Dream. And this is just an unbelievable story of your family
and
your passion and your perseverance. And my heart goes out to you, sir.
Thank you very much. Very much appreciated. And yeah, thank you guys for coming on and listening to me ramble. I really appreciate it. Drink some Pinot, make your life better.
That's right. We will see you in Windsor.
Thanks, Roger.
Indeed.
Thank you, Roger. Cheers, angels. Be good to one another. This is what makes the world go around, your kindness and great wine.
And that's me waving without it vibrating. That's great.